Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Welcome to the program with me, Assumpta Latos. Coming up, the Nigerian government continues to sink into chaos.
The Nigerian security agents find it very difficult to actually counter what the Boko Haram are doing. So it becomes easier for them to abduct women. It becomes easier for them to unleash terror to go and burn towns and villages.
The government of South Sudan and the rebels agree to form a unity government.
Simply signing an agreement doesn't necessarily mean that the two parties are any more committed to peace than they were before. The real proof is going to be what happens in the next 60 days.
Those stories and more coming up right here at Africa Link in the next 25 minutes.
Top story.
We begin in Nigeria. The government there is under attack. Apart from being criticized for its failure to contain the Boko Haram insurgency, the appointment of a fierce critic of President Jonathan to an influential traditional post also puts the government in an uncomfortable position. At the same time, civil society activists are alarmed by the confiscation by the military of critical newspapers. This report by Catherine Gensler has been adapted by Victoria Engels.
The newspaper kiosks dotted around Nigeria's cities are generally well stocked. Dozens of papers are on display, with headlines critical of the country's current predicament and its rulers. But these are not easy times for Nigeria's print journalists and publishers. Over the last few days, the military has been confiscating editions of the bigger newspapers, such as Leadership or The Punch, making it impossible for them to be distributed or sold. Garba Mohammed, president of the Nigerian Union of Journalists, is alarmed.
We feel that it is a very, very serious threat. We have condemned it in total.
An army spokesman said that the seizure of the newspapers had nothing to do with their content. It had been a security measure intended to prevent the publication of material relevant to national security. Such remarks failed to reassure anybody in Nigeria, civil society included. Mohammed Mustafa Yahaya heads the non-governmental organization Democratic Action Group.
It's undemocratic and it's not encouraging, and I expect condemnation of this act by the presidency, condemnation of this act by the authorities concerned.
This seems unlikely. So far, there has been no official comment. In general, politicians and government representatives prefer to stay silent when journalists suggest that the military is getting out of control. Mohammed Mustafa Yahaya has a clear opinion on the country's armed forces.
Yeah, they're getting too strong, because if you see the trend of how things is going, you know, it's getting too strong. It's not healthy for the democracy.
It is against this backdrop that the appointment of a traditional leader has created a furore throughout Nigeria's political and social sphere. Last Sunday, Zanusi Lamido Zanusi was named Emir of Kano, making him the second most influential Muslim leader in Nigeria. In February, Zanusi had been discharged from his position as head of Nigeria's central bank by President Goodluck Jonathan after complaining that $20 billion of the country's oil revenue had gone missing. Zanusi was chosen out of three candidates for the post of Emir by the governor of Kano, Rabiui Musa Kwangwazo, who in turn defected from President Jonathan's People's Democratic Party, PDP, to the opposition, All People's Congress, APC, last year. There were clashes in Kano on Monday as hundreds of supporters of Zanusi battled with backers of his main rival, the late Emir's eldest son, Aminu Ado Bayero, who allegedly had the support of the PDP. Zanusi may nurture resentment towards Jonathan, having lost his job as the head of the central bank. But Mohammed Mustafa Yahaya believes the two should bury their hatchet.
I think whatever is their grievances or differences should be forgiven and forgotten, so that they put ahead. They put a very good working relationship.
Meanwhile, the ruling PDP has now congratulated Zanusi on becoming Emir of Kano, but urged him to fulfill his duties without pursuing political objectives. In Jos, capital of Plateau State, the Catholic Archbishop Ignatius Kayigama, who is also the head of the Nigerian Bishops' Conference, sought to reassure those who fear more friction between Nigeria's diverse ethnic and religious groups.
Well, this is Nigeria, and sometimes
even in religion, politics, shows his head. And even in traditional affairs, like in the case of traditional rulers.
Kaigama assumes that interfaith dialogue will be possible with the new emir in office.
The new emir is an enlightened person, and therefore he is aware of the importance of interreligious dialogue and the need for peaceful coexistence, especially between Christians and Muslims.
Observers, however, fear that the government's less than enthusiastic response to the emir's appointment might have actually intensified mistrust between Muslims and Christians. In any case, the federal government and military seem determined to press ahead with their campaign against their critics in the opposition and the media.
That report was by Catherine Gensler. Remaining in Nigeria, the Boko Haram insurgency has been shaking the northeastern part of the country and has made many people refugees in their own country. Most affected are women and children. After the abduction of more than 200 schoolgirls in Chibok in April, the Islamists have now seized further 20 women in the same region. To find out how women are coping there, I called Hajiya Hafsat Mohammed Baba, a co-founder of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign and head of the Global Initiatives for Women and Children.
In as much as there's continuous, you know, abduction of women, there's also continuous movement of women and children to safer places. Maybe going to other states. They're also at the border of neighboring countries, most especially Cameroon and Niger.
And what is the latest you have about the Chibok kidnapped schoolgirls?
We also have the latest about 20 women being kidnapped. That was 2 days ago. Then we also have the Chibok girls. And I was opportunity to be in Maiduguri last week to offer psychosocial support and also trauma counseling for those that were rescued. And we spent 4 days with them. The first 2 days was really very difficult, you know, crying, not accepting us. You know, we had difficulty breaking the ice and so on. But on the third day, we were happy that we were able to make them talk. And by the time we actually concluded our stay in Maiduguri, it was really fantastic. The children were able to open up, and some of them even shared their stories. Even after coming back home, they have been calling me, and we're still communicating, and we're still offering support.
And what is your experience with the government in your campaign for Chibok Girls, or as you call it, Bring Back Our Girls campaign?
In Kaduna, our experience initially, you know, when we were going to hold the protest, we were met with resistance from the security agents. At the same time, we wrote letters to intimate the government that we're going to hold peaceful protests. But unfortunately, when our letter got to the Commissioner of Police in Kaduna State, he requested for my presence, and I was there. And he made it clear that they are not ready to support that protest. But I told him that constitutionally, we have the right to hold that protest because it is peaceful, and this is what we are demanding for. So eventually, we were confined to a certain place. We were not allowed movement, but we just want to make sure that we held that protest. And we were able to get the media to cover the protests, and we were happy that the presence of the media really made an impact, both national and international media.
Boko Haram got the world's attention when it abducted over 200 schoolgirls. Is this latest abduction a sign that the Islamist group is using abduction as its new tool to unleash terror in northern eastern Nigeria?
Yes, you're correct. In fact, they are unleashing terror not only in the northeast, but also in the whole of the country. They can strike at any point in time. So people live in absolute fear. But in the northeast, you know, the abduction is too much. Unfortunately, they are so heavily armed with sophisticated weapons and so on. And the Nigerian security agents find it very difficult to actually counter what the Boko Haram are doing. So it becomes easier for them to abduct women. It becomes easier for them to unleash terror, to go and burn towns and villages, and also to pack food because they don't have food in their camps. They scare people, they shoot people, they kill people, and then they take the women and they take the children and also pack the food and go away with it. And apart from that, we're also facing rape of children. And even yesterday, I was contacted. A 3-year-old girl has been raped, and it has become so rampant that our laws are really very weak, and we need to strengthen them so that at least, you know, we can ensure that adequate punishment is given to those people that perpetrate this heinous crime.
Hajia Afsat Mohammed Baba speaking about the plight of women in northeastern Nigeria. This is Africa Link coming to you from Bonn, Germany. And with you, it's me, Assumpta Latus.
Africa Link, every weekday on Deutsche Welle.
After a long wait, the government and rebels in South Sudan have finally come to terms. They have agreed to end a six-month civil war by forming a unity government within 60 days. But that is not yet a reason to celebrate, critics say, as no one knows how long this deal will hold. Previous deals collapsed only a few hours after they were signed. Kesi Copeland is a South Sudan expert with the International Crisis Group. I asked her how optimistic she is that the unity government will be formed.
What's going to be critical are two things. One is how much pressure the region can exert on the two parties, and how much will the parties actually have to comply with the agreement they've signed.
What are the main obstacles there?
On the side of the government, they believe they are a legitimately elected government. They say that the opposition is trying to overthrow them and that they're trying to take power by force. So they don't believe they should be asked to engage in any kind of transitional arrangement. And so moving them out of that position is very difficult indeed. And the opposition believe that their people were attacked and that they're fighting to defend the Nuer, which are the second largest tribe, from a state that was quite violent towards Nuer civilians at the beginning of the conflict. And that really, if they don't continue to fight, that the government can't be trusted. So if they lay down their arms, that the government won't make any changes at all. So overcoming these very entrenched positions is very, very difficult.
Before the agreement, a top IGAD representative accused both parties of being determined to solve their conflicts with military means. Has he now been proved wrong?
The government and opposition have signed three agreements since the outbreak of war on the 15th of December last year. Each of those have been violated almost immediately. So simply signing an agreement doesn't necessarily mean that the two parties are any more committed to peace than they were before. The real proof of any renewed or new commitment, should we say, is going to be what happens in the next 60 days.
Well, is there any chance that a political solution could be found between these two parties?
That's what the transitional government is looking to, trying to form a government that represents a sort of political solution. But the transitional government remains a very unclear concept. We don't know what its composition will be. We don't know what its mandate will be. We don't know the time frame. Is it a short period to usher in elections? Is it a longer period in which we're going to fundamentally change the nature of the state and pass the new constitution, which South Sudan is well overdue for? So these are the questions that are really going to indicate both how serious a political agreement the transitional government is, and then also how serious the parties are.
Well, IGAD has threatened for the first time to take punitive measures against any party which fails to honor its commitments. Is such a threat likely to influence the two sides? Will they take it seriously?
The two parties both want the IGAD mediation team to take their side, so to speak. They are both concerned about the threat of various forms of sanctions, military, economic, or otherwise, that may emerge from IGAD. So to some extent, the reason that they signed the agreement, the reason that they're even at the table to begin with, is largely because of the way that they do view the region and how much they don't want to be on the receiving end of such punitive measures. So it's quite a powerful threat.
So far, the international community was rather reluctant with heavy sanctions. What should they, for example, the EU and USA, do now to put more pressure on both parties?
The targeted sanctions that the US government imposed about 2 months ago, they've not had the large impact that people wanted. And that's something we often see with sanctions, that the threat of sanctions in many cases is more powerful than actually using sanctions themselves. So keeping the threat on the table, exploring other options, such as an arms embargo to prevent the two sides from continuing to buy weapons, other things like looking at oil revenues and where those are going, putting them in a trusteeship. So there are a lot of different options that are on the table and need to be thought through, because simply the targeted sanctions may not be enough on their own to fundamentally change the nature of the conflict.
Casey Copeland speaking from Nairobi.
Behind the headlines.
Well, in Behind the Headlines this week, we have a rather jolly kind of a story. Last weekend, for the first time in more than 5 years here in Germany, we had real African weather. The front pages of almost all newspapers, as well as radio and TV news bulletins, seemed to have just one topic, the heat. The sun was shining nonstop and the temperature went up to way over 30 degrees. The only things missing were the papayas and mango trees. Oh gosh, how I miss those things. Now, that is what made our very own Maxwell Souk take a recorder and microphone and find out what Africans here were doing in this time of the year, which we call summer.
I am on my way towards what seems like a huge African party at a run-hour park, not far from Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany. The mouth-watering aroma of grilled chicken, beef, and sausages greet me. The sun is hot and summer is in the air, a moment of celebration for Africans living in Germany, because the nice sunshine alone allows them not only to move about comfortably without wearing sweaters and winter jackets, but also to have gatherings and parties. In this occasion, the Burkinabes are having their annual grill party where all citizens from Burkina Faso and their friends living in and around Bonn meet to party together. Chantal Ouedraogo, a 36-year-old Burkinabe living in Bonn, tells me the sunshine makes her feel like she's back home in Africa.
We have a good weather today. It is sunny, it is warm, it is nice, and we are enjoying it. It's sunny like Africa, it's hot like Africa. Yes, yeah, I enjoy it.
Another member of the Burkinabe Association, John Ahmed, also shares his joy.
It's a very nice weather. Everybody knows that in Germany it's very cold, but at that time it's very nice. You see, everybody's outside enjoying himself, so it's really nice. It's, we have a session, we make that one time in the year. So, and we said we make it today, and we had luck. It was really warm, and it didn't rain, not cold, so it's okay.
Similar activities involving people from various African countries take place across many cities in Germany. At the university center in Cologne, a group of Africans also gathered to play football at the time I arrived. Desi Kadema, a Congolese resident in Cologne, explains further.
We have different countries from Africa here. We do that in summer, in winter. Obviously, it's a bit very cold. There is always a problem, but in summer, there is always a very good thing here. We play, after playing, we have a drink. Like today, it's a very good weather, 30 degrees. We're going to have a drink. After a drink, we're going to do a grill. We're going to eat a piece of meat together with some guys here, drink, and then everyone will go to his house.
For Abubakar Suwala, who hails from Ghana, summertime is like a family reunion for him. And the getting together of so many Africans makes him feel much like home.
I'm enjoying this place like I'm in Ghana right now. Because now we are in the sun, we are in the summer, and then I feel enjoying it. And here we are living here like family. You can see there is Cameroonian, there is Ghana, there is Mali. Anyone is here, we are enjoying like family.
And the good mood is not just evident amongst Africans, but almost everyone I come across. No wonder many of the Africans I spoke to say they wait for the next summer season, the moment it ends.
Maxwell Souk reporting there. Sounds like he had fun doing that report. Let's turn our attention to the World Cup now. As the countdown to the beginning of the FIFA World Cup narrows down, the situation in North Nigeria is getting tenser. Just a day before the opening of the World Cup, soldiers in northern Nigeria have shut down all venues to screen live matches. They hope to starve off attacks by Boko Haram. But farther south, the situation is different. Our reporter Moki Kinzeka went to Lagos to see how people there are preparing themselves to watch their team, the Super Eagles, perform in Brazil.
It is business as usual in Nigeria's commercial city Lagos. Jerseys of the country's soccer squad, nicknamed the Super Eagles of Nigeria, are on the hands of almost every roadside vendor. 28-year-old fan Blessing Ngosi says she is buying the jersey to support her team to victory, even though she will not be traveling to Brazil.
I know that the Super Eagles will go places. Since I'm not opportunity to go for the tournament in Brazil, I must buy their jerseys.
Apparently, all supporters of the Super Eagles here have trust and confidence in the team that includes Ahmed Musa, Shola Amiobi, Emmanuel Emenike, and Vincent Enyema. They are part of the 23-man squad to represent Nigeria in the Brazil FIFA World Cup. Charles Uche, a hawker in Lagos, says it is the best selection Nigeria has made.
I have assurance and confidence in my coach. I've seen the lineup. The coach did not make any mistake. And I believe somebody like our goalkeeper, Vincent Enyama, I trust him very well. And also like our forward and the striker, Victor Moses, and also Emmanuel Emenike. People were saying, since they started like this, would they be able to reach the end? But finally, they're the one who won the cup. So for that, my team will perform well.
Cosmas Uze, another businessman in Nigeria, adds that the team will bring the trophy if the referees are trustworthy.
We have the confidence that the cup will come here. It is the turn of Africa. So we are sure, and I'm really sure that the cup will come here if the referees are good. But if they are not good, then we can even fight to see that even the quarterfinal, we attend it.
The man who has instilled confidence and trust in the Super Eagles, people here say, is the team coach Stephen Keshi. He took almost a shattered team and led it to a successful African Nations Cup in South Africa in 2013. They emerged as champions of Africa. James, who is popularly known in Ikeja as Mandela, says it is time for Stephen Keshi to prove to the world that Africa too has good coaches.
I believe in our coach, Stephen Keshi. I think he's going to do more better now. His boys are also performing very well also. They are very, very equipped. I think this time around is the time for Africans to take the World Cup.
Some sports analysts, like the Lagos-based journalist Toyin Ibitiyi of Supersport, however, think that Nigeria is a very unpredictable team.
With Nigeria, some moments the team looks like they can beat anybody. Other moments they look a bit here and there. They've done well in Africa, but you'd notice that they really haven't beaten European opposition. They really haven't done well against European opposition. And you're talking about Mexico, the last time we had two draws. Italy was a good game, but it was still a draw. So I worry a little bit. I think Nigeria will make it out of the group, but after that, it's a very tough call.
Nigeria is one of Africa's five nations vying for the World Cup besides Algeria, Cameroon, Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. Many football pundits agree that it is the African team that can spring surprises and go beyond the quarterfinal stage, which is the highest an African team has attained.
Moki Kinzeka reporting. Next on our World Cup coverage is Ghana. Don't miss that tomorrow right here at Africa Link.
Opinion.
In opinion this week, we go to South Sudan. We heard earlier that the government of South Sudan and rebels have agreed to form a unity government within 60 days. What do you reckon? Is this a reason for South Sudanese to celebrate? Send us your thoughts through our email address, which is feedback.africa@dw.de, or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110. Bonn, Germany, or send us a text message to +491609575910. And now, a summary of what we have been covering. Nigeria sinks farther into chaos as critical newspapers are silenced. The government of South Sudan and rebels agree to form a unity government. and our special World Cup coverage on African teams in Brazil. That's all we have time for in this edition. Join us at the same time tomorrow for more stories from across the continent. Till then, it's me, Assumpta Latus, saying goodbye.